What happens when we die? Does our soul go to heaven? Does our spirit go into the universe and we live on forever? Or is that it? Darkness for eternity. Today we talk about near-death experience. We have author Rosemary Thornton talking about not only surviving her husband's suicide and stage 2 cancer, but experiencing death and no heartbeat for more than 10 minutes. And she is here today, alive and well, but renewed. We have Rosemary Thornton on the show today. I'm Tony Sweet, talking about near-death experiences. So please welcome to Truth Be Told, Rosemary Thornton. Hello, hello.
Hello, I really like that reception.
You like that? Well,
applause,
you know,
applause.
I didn't even have to pay him to come in. So,
nice.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. You know, we've talked about near death before, but it's always interesting because so many people always have questions about that. You know, one thing that as soon as we're born, they always say, two things you're going to do is pay taxes and you're going to die. and
I've done both.
And you've done both. And before we get started, I know some people probably have heard my story, but I have not had a near death, but my grandfather did before I was born in the 1960s, before, you know, all the books and stuff were written, in a small town of Granola, Kansas, where he, was in the hospital, passed away. He saw the light. He came out into an open field. He saw his mother there, and then she said, it's not your time. And so he goes, I didn't want to come back, but they didn't let me stay. And then he came back and lived another about 15 years. So before, and the thing is, I think it changes a lot of people's lives, and a lot of people come back with more intuition or, you know, psychic abilities. And I want to know, let's go back before you had your near-death experience and just kind of give us a brief summary of what you were doing before then, and then you had some tragedy even before your near death.
I did. I was an author. In 2002, I wrote a book about the old Sears Kit homes. They came in 12,000 pieces of house, came to a railway, and that little book brought me many blessings. And ultimately, I ended up on PBS History Detectives and you know, had a lot. BBC Radio, NPR, right, had a good run. And about that time, shortly thereafter, I met and married a man I considered to be the love of my life. And the only disappointment was I was, I guess, 45 or 46 when I met him and married him. I think we were engaged within 2 months. And he was an attorney. He was a city attorney and a litigator. And I just couldn't believe my good fortune. I felt my life had not been an easy one. And I felt in finding and marrying this man, all the sadness was behind me, which was great, sweet relief. And I had always been very intuitive, very sensitive, very empathic. And we were married 10 years. And one day he came home for lunch and put a gun in his mouth and ended his life. And I was, to say I was devastated is an understatement. I was absolutely inconsolable. I probably was on the cusp of a psychotic break. Those who loved me wanted to put me in a psychiatric hospital because I had always been the strong one. You know, right. I wrote this goofy little self-published book and it became a big hit out of nowhere. I suddenly was a national expert. You know, it was a good run. And I went from being the strong, independent, capable woman to walking around almost in circles and saying, I have to die to be with him. I mean, it's typical of trauma victims. Shock will mess you up. I think shock of that nature, that kind of trauma, I mean, he did this with a gun. At our home, shock of that kind, that level is more akin to a stroke. I lost my ability to read. I lost the ability to eat for a time. I lost a tremendous amount of weight. On and on and on. It was a very bad scene. I ended up living out of my car for a short time, and a friend intervened and said, "You can't live out of your car." But I couldn't find a place I was comfortable. And until you experience losing somebody, like a spouse or a child, to suicide, there's no way to describe or imagine what it's like. So 2.5 years later. You know, a little aside briefly, I guess about 6 months into this, I met with a financial planner to figure out, you know, what to do with the bit of money I had. And she said, where do you see yourself in 2 years? And I said, in 2 years, I'll be dead. Human beings aren't meant to survive this much depression, trauma, and horror in their life. And the nightmares, oh my gosh, the nightmares. Every night I had nightmares that I got home just as he was putting the gun in his mouth and tried to stop him. I mean, every night I lived through this again and again. I hated to go to sleep and I hated to be awake. So at 2.5 years out, I had some symptoms. I went to a doctor and I was diagnosed with cervical cancer stage 2. And it was actually during a related surgical procedure. They made a series of boo-boos and they sent me home. And I was bleeding profusely, and I told pretty much everybody at the hospital, listen, I got a problem here. But they said, oh, once you get home and lie down, you'll be fine. By the way, did you know women die? Let me get this right. Women, I think it's women die more often than men from heart attacks. Or this was true 20 years ago, because women tend to be dismissed. You know, when they say I'm having radiating chest pain in their jaw, they tend to be dismissed. So anyway, they sent me home in a terrible state. And I ended up being taken by ambulance. As soon as I got home, I realized I'm bleeding to death. In fact, I was standing in my shower. I had white carpet in my home. And, you know, being the good little clean person I was, I didn't want to mess up the carpet, bleeding so badly. So I stepped into my nice big white walk-in shower so I could bleed to death there. And while I was in that shower, I realized I have to make a decision. You know, I had been fantasizing about ending my own life ever since he ended his. And I was just getting through life some days, 15 minutes at a time. And I thought, you've been wanting to commit suicide for 2.5 years. Now's your chance. And this won't be your fault. And I thought, just sit down on the shower floor and this will be over pretty quick. And I realized I had to make a decision. So I thought about the people, like the woman who saved me from living out of my car. I thought about the man, Milton, who had intervened and said, don't put her in a psych ward. That'll finish her off. I will take care of her. And he was. I mean, he took care of me for 2.5 years. I thought about all the people, and of course my children, who'd invested so much in keeping me alive. So I made a conscious decision to walk out of that shower into the living room, say, I'm bleeding to death, take me to a hospital. And an ambulance was summoned. I was taken to another hospital. They made more mistakes. And my friend, Milton, sat with me. The doctor and the nurse came and examined me and talked to me. And they made some boo-boos, but one of them was they packed me with gauze. I mean, this had been a cervical biopsy to determine how far the cancer had spread. So there was a lot of blood going on, and there shouldn't have been.
Right.
But the ER, they packed me with gauze and left me in that room alone with my buddy Milton, and they had me hooked up to a blood pressure cuff and had a pulse ox on my finger. But one of the things the nurse did, sitting by my side there, she was, you know, I was on the gurney, and this wonderful RN about my age. At one point, I grabbed her hand, and, you know, while I was still conscious, and while the doctor was examining me, I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. And she said, oh, honey, we have many solutions for this. We're not going to let you die. And she was so comforting, and she believed it. You know, you can look in somebody's eyes and tell if they're just telling a story or telling you what they really believe. I could see in her eyes she was not going to let me go. So, but they packed me with gauze and then left the little cubicle and left me alone there with my friend. Well, shortly after they left, I lost consciousness. And my buddy Milton, by my bedside there, he said he was, you know, he said, well, the doctor's been here. She's going to be okay. And he said he looked at my blood pressure monitor at one point and it said 32 over 25.
Oh, my God.
Which you're pretty much dead by that point.
I was going to say, I'm surprised they even didn't call it then.
Yeah. So he said, this is what's so cool to me. I mean, I experienced, I don't remember this part. He said he was getting ready to get up and, you know, yell for the nurse at 32 over 25. I mean, he was a former Vietnam era Army medic, and he said he knew that was real bad. My eyes opened and I tried to sit up on the gurney and I reached up to heaven. He said, you talk to somebody only you could see. And after just a few words, you plopped back down on the gurney, your eyes shut, and that's when the blood pressure monitor read error. In other words, it was lower than 32 over 25. Meanwhile, I'm having a great time. I was unconscious at the time of my death in a deep dreamless state. And I woke up at the moment of my death, literally being catapulted out of my body. It was almost jarring, the way I was thrown out of that body. And the best way I can describe, I told people, it was like popping, like toast popping out of a toaster. I was literally catapulted away from that body. And it was so cool to me. I mean, I used to be a newspaper reporter. I'm a writer. I spent 6 years researching one book. I've written 9 books to tell you the flavor of my particular OCD. But what was so cool to me was the second I was flying through the air, floating further and further away from my body, the first words out of my new mouth were, my heart has stopped. I don't, how do I know that? I thought, I don't know, but I know that's right. My heart has stopped. And then I thought, isn't everyone going to be surprised how this turned out? I feel like I should have a chance to put on my tombstone, I told you I was having a problem. And so floating further and further away from my body, I knew what was happening. And one of my first thoughts also was, I'm dying. And then being a writer slash editor, I said, actually, you're not dying. You're dead. And it cracked me up because, you know, when you're going through your reward, the most important thing is correcting your tense. So I laughed out loud and I heard my funny little giggle. And I thought, oh my gosh, everything I am has come with me. And I thought, what did I leave behind on that gurney? And I thought, I left behind the anxiety. I've always struggled with anxiety and the fears and the worries and the regrets and the recriminations and the guilt about my husband's suicide. I mean, every negative emotion was what I left behind.
Hmm.
What went with me was light and peace and joy and comfort. And I was in this blackness floating away. And I even thought to myself, I should be frightened. I don't like blackness. You know, I always had to be able to have a light to see what was going on around. Wow. Even when I slept, yeah, I had to sleep in a room that had some light. I thought, but I'm the most peaceful I've ever known. And at one point, I remember thinking about Paul's Bible verse. I think it's Corinthians, where he talks about the peace that passeth all understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. I realized this is what Paul was talking about. There's no way to explain this peace. And it wasn't peace as a noun. It was peace as a verb. It was like this blackness was actively comforting me, actively calming me. It's like a mother's love multiplied exponentially. And I was happy. And one of the things after my husband's suicide, I asked people, oh, I don't know, once or twice every 10 minutes, I asked everybody, will I ever be happy again? Because I knew I probably would never be happy again. I mean, one of the things my husband did was left a note blaming me.
He blamed you. Wow. That,
right.
That leaves you with a lot of...
It did. There's no do-overs on that one. And, of course, the cops had found it first, and that story got legs, as they say. And it was very easy to blame the wife because, you know, poor husband's dead, et cetera. So my life had just been hell. So floating away from my body, I'm like, you know what? I did not do this to myself. I even responsibly got in an ambulance and went to the hospital. I am not culpable in this. And I remember thinking, my family, those who love me, I didn't even use the words my family. I thought those who love me won't know the horror and the guilt and the shame of losing their mother to suicide. They'll just say, oh, it was a catastrophic medical mistake. They won't suffer what I had suffered. So, I mean, it was like somebody had taken, I've always thought of myself or had before my husband's suicide as something of a smart cookie, you know, smarter than the average bear. And in this experience, it's like I had been living on 30 amp service and now I'd been ramped up to 100,000 amps. My intellect was, and my intelligence was just supercharged in too many ways to count. And shortly into this experience, I felt the presence of a loving, gentle, caring, powerful presence to my left. And I thought, boy, it's just getting better and better, you know, that now I have this person, this being beside me. And I'm still floating in this blackness. And I don't know where I'm going. I mean, I'm a type A hardcore control freak. I don't know where I'm going. I don't care. I'm so happy. I'm so at peace. I'm so enveloped in perfect love. It's, again, perfect love times a billion. So I turn to my left and look up. And I think, this is kind of funny. I don't have a head, I think. But maybe I do have a head. And yet I'm turning to my left. And I recognize it's my left. But I said with a lilt in my voice, and who are you? I thought, you know, this is great. I don't know. I don't have names. I got nothing, but I want to know who this is. And again, I'm a very curious person by nature. You can't write books if you're not curious. And the answer was, and the answer came telepathically. I heard myself speaking. I heard myself giggling. I remember thinking, I don't think I have vocal cords, and I know I don't have breath sounds, and yet I am producing sound. Which I thought, wow, sound, all that we are is spiritual. Everything went with me, my giggle, my sound. But anyway, so I said, and who are you? The answer again, telepathically, immediate, before I could even finish the sentence, the answer was, you, Rosemary, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. And I was like, wow.
That's powerful.
Yeah, I mean, that's Genesis 1, I think it's Genesis 1:27.
Right.
They were made in the image and likeness of God. And I had studied that Bible verse throughout my life and studied multiple Bible commentaries and interpretations and such. But now I got it. I still get it. So I, oh my gosh, this is just getting better and better and better. And this experience, I mean, if you told me later that I had been dead for 2 months, I would believe it. Time has no meaning. And I know, you know, one of my favorite quotes, Einstein said, to those of us who are committed physicists, the past, present, and future are only illusion, however persistent. And that is so true. We see time as linear, mm-hmm. you know, the past, the present, the future. I can't tell you how long I was gone. I know medically, humanly, physically, it was more than 10 minutes. So at some point in this experience, I was no longer floating in this blackness, but I was in a white room. And it was, again, being an architectural story, and I kind of looked around. There were no wall sconces. There were no ceiling fixtures. The light was coming from everywhere and nowhere. The walls were luminescent, iridescent, bright, bright, white, everywhere, white. And now I'm on my feet, and I think I'm standing on legs or feet or something, but I still have a physique of some kind. I still have a form. And in front of me, some distance, I don't know, 15, 20 feet, I saw a door. And all my life, I had read about near-death experiences. I had been absolutely enchanted by them. I read every book I could get my hands on. And, you know, back in the 70s, I think Raymond Moody's book came out, I think, in 76, that little paperback. I read that so many times, I memorized it. And then I read Danion Brinkley's book.
Oh, yeah, I've interviewed Danion many times.
I'd read all the books, and I knew what that door meant. I knew the door meant that we were done, that I was crossing the Rubicon. I couldn't wait to get to that door, and I thought, I don't know how I make these legs move, but I think if I have an intention to get to that door, I will move, and I did. And as I'm moving toward that door, I'm with a different spiritual being, and the best way I can describe it is an angel, and maybe it was many angels, but I know I was again still encompassed in this perfect love. And as I moved through this light, the room had like a vapor or a fog is the best way I can describe it. But it was like a pea soup London fog. It was very, 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 very dense. And yet it wasn't water vapor. I wasn't hot or cold or cool or damp. And I asked this angel with me, I said, I feel like I should be able to focus on the individual droplets of whatever this is. And the angel said, your spiritual eyes have not acclimated to your new atmosphere yet, to the new environment. And the angel said, what you're seeing is particulate light. You're seeing particles of light. And they were alive. They swirled around me. They didn't just drop down. They literally, it was like they all had life in them. They all had life and light and love in them. They were all energized. I guess that's the best word I can use. They were all energized. And it felt like there's an old hymn, I think it's about 120 years old. Going home, going home, I'm just going home. And I thought, that's what I'm doing. I'm just going home. And it really felt like I was one billionth of a drop of water being reunited with the ocean. That's how fast all this felt. So as I approached the door, I couldn't wait to get through it. I was like, let's get this on the road, you know, out of my way. Everyone out of my way. Don't hinder me in any way. And the angel told me, you kind of need to go back. And I said, do not ask that of me. My life is horrible. Please don't ask that of me. And I literally put my right hand up to push through this door. And I was, one, a little miffed the door was shut. But two, I remember thinking, that's pretty interesting that I'm right-handed on earth, right-handed in heaven. And I still have physique. I mean, really, everything we are goes with us. And as I did this, I did pause, and I asked, is this the divine will for my life? And before I could even get the words out, the answer again was immediate. And the answer was very precise. It was no, but whatever you decide, whether you go forward or whether you go back, you go with all of God's love and mercy and care and grace. That was the other part, love and mercy and grace and care. And I thought, I'll take that deal. I'm going forward. I don't want to go back. And as I got closer to moving through that door, I saw an image of that nurse who had helped me, that nurse who had promised me she wasn't going to let me die. And in this, I can only describe it as a vision, she was sitting in a hospital supply room on a little metal stool, leaning forward, her head in her hands, sobbing uncontrollably. And she was saying, I promised that woman I wasn't going to let her die, and I lost her. And my first thought was, oh, man, please don't do this to me. I mean, I've always been very empathic, and that hurt a lot. And then I thought, well, you know what? She's an RN. She's about my age. She's been through this before. She'll get through it. I have to go. I can't go back. And the angel, there's a lot of communication back and forth, but one of the things I was told, if I agreed to go back, I'd be healed. And I was told that was the white room, that whether we go on to heaven, or in my case, even if I go back, it's a cleansing. It's like a spiritual car wash. You know, some people die from a disease process, some people die from age, and we can't go into heaven thinking that, you know, we still have a disease process, or we still have bad joints, or we still have a head injury, or whatever the case may be. And I was told that is the purpose of the white room, to purify us so that we're ready for heaven, to strip away the word that was used was to strip away the muck of the earth. So I was told if I agreed to go back, I would be healed, and that wasn't enough. I said, that's fine, but don't ask me, please let me go. And then that vision of the nurse turned into more than a vision. I felt her agony. I felt her emotional pain, and I recognized that deep grief as the same grief I had felt, that knife in the heart pain after my husband's suicide. And it was very intense, and I don't know how to describe it except to say it felt like it hit me in the solar plexus so hard that it knocked me back up a little. And I thought, if I can spare one human being that much agony, I guess I have to go back. And the last thing I said was, this is going to ruin that nurse's day if I die. And in a millisecond, less than a millisecond, I was back in that body. There was no whoosh. There was no moving backwards. There was none of that. I was back in that body. And there was a tremendous amount of activity happening around my gurney. There was a lot of stuff going on. They had actually called in, according to my buddy there in that little ER, they called in everybody, including the receptionist, to work on me. And, you know, I know that the medical people like to think it was their bravado, their capabilities, their competence that brought somebody back. I had always had a theory that the decision to stay or to go is made on a spiritual level, and then this material physical picture must manipulate around to match the spiritual decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that with more than ever. And so I was rushed by ambulance to a bigger, better hospital. And there, again, a lot of excitement. And then the next morning, I got the real doctor. I didn't get the doctor that was so young she had play school on her stethoscope. I got the real physician that was about my age, because that I was rushed back to the hospital that had discharged me bleeding profusely. And he told me bluntly, and this was very gratifying to know, or I should say satisfying, I guess. He said, yes, you had a heart attack. And I said, oh, wrong chart, buddy. Look again. You know, I bike, I walk, I'm very active. He said, no, this wasn't your traditional heart attack. He said, you lost so much blood, your heart stopped. And he said, you apparently have quite a bit of heart damage, because the heart throws off enzymes, and they find that in your blood, which is how they knew I'd had a heart attack. And I said, well, you know, it's okay, I'm fine. The angel said if I agreed to come back, I'd be just fine.
And they looked at you probably like, what?
Yeah, I mean, they took me for all kinds of tests and all kinds of stuff and all kinds of blood work, and they stayed very, 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 very busy. Because I learned later that when you bleed to death to the point that your heart stops, yeah, sometimes they can get you back, but they can't even do CPR on you until they plug the leak. So it's a three-step process. They got to plug the leak. They got to find the leak, plug the leak, refill the tank, and then restart the heart. And they can't do CPR because, one, it's just going to push out more blood.
Right.
So the amazing thing about this, when I came back, I really felt like I had been granted, one, I really felt rebooted by the Creator. I really did. I felt like my intellect had been, I felt like some of that supercharging stuck. I felt like I came back. Somebody said it was Rosemary V2, and then somebody else said, no, it's Rosemary V29. You skipped a lot of upgrades on this one. And I think that's accurate. And I was in the hospital for 5 days. It was a big deal. It was kind of a mess. But, you know, every test they did, what I was going to say is there's an expectation medically when you have that catastrophic event that often people of my age come back either compromised or they come back with multiple ancillary issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because apparently when you bleed to death, all the cool stuff in your body that creates clots to prevent problems, your veins and arteries get sticky. And so often when people come back, they have issues.
Circulations under, and everything else. Yeah.
And absolutely none of that happened. And there was an expectation that my heart, even though it wasn't showing up on tests, I might have, you know, I might see some issues, but nothing. And in fact, I was a little miffed when I was put in the hospital and my, oh my gosh, I guess it's hematocrit, the red blood cell count, had been 13.2 when I started the day, and it was 6.4 upon admittance to the hospital. And I told the angels, I said, hey, I thought we said Rosemary. Fine, when she comes back, all problems erased. And the angels, what they told me, oh my gosh, the angels talked to me so much in those days in the hospital. It was great. But what they said was, we know that you are the doubting Thomas of the 21st century. We wanted you to know, yes, you did bleed to death. Yes, it was that catastrophic. And yes, we brought you back, and it looks like a miracle. But yes, we did that. And then 2 weeks later, I had to go back to the hospital for another blood test, and all my blood work was textbook perfect. And the expectation was it would take 2 to 3 months for the bone marrow to produce sufficient red and white blood cells. And in fact, the doctor put the paper down and said, I see there's a mistake on your blood work. And I said, well, what's the mistake? And they said, well, your numbers, they're textbook perfect. That's impossible. And I said, no, it isn't. I'm back on my bike and I'm back to walking. And they said, what? They said, that's not possible. And then I had to change doctors. I had been under the care of a gynecological oncologist. And I had been referred there by my gynecologist after the first diagnosis. And I was scheduled to start chemo and radiation in a handful of days. And he would not hear my story, but the angel said I'd be healed. And I did have to find another oncologist. In fact, I went to another town about 45 minutes away. And it took a lot of tests and a lot of time. And it was 2 months later, but there was a second surgery. And it was affirmed that there was not one cell of cancer left.
That, I mean, that's an amazing story and an experience. But when you talk to people that have experienced NDEs, in case you want to know what that, didn't say it too fast, near-death experience, you hear some just stories that you're like, that can't be true. And before we get into really what your life became after coming back from this experience, did you believe in near death, or did you believe in the afterlife before this happened? And when your husband committed suicide, I mean, did you hate God? Did you, you know, stop believing? Tell us your mindset before this happened. I mean, what was your thoughts about near death and the afterlife and heaven, whatever you want to call it?
Well, those are good questions. One of the things that happened to me as I was floating in that blackness was I realized in this experience, I guess the best way to say it is within this consciousness of my time on Earth, I said, I've been here before. And the angel said, yeah, you have. They said, remember your mom said you were given up for dead as an infant at the hospital? Yeah, we sent you back then too. So my mother had a remarkable story. She didn't tell me until I was in my 30s that after I was born, I developed a staph infection, you know, brand new little baby, her first baby girl, turned into blood poisoning. 3 weeks this went on. She was beside herself. She prayed every night and every day, invoked the nuns in the Catholic hospital to pray, went home and called a Christian Science friend, asked her to pray. I mean, my mother, of course, as any mother would, put everything she had into saving me. And then, gosh, I don't like being emotional. And then, but this is my mama. And then came right. The day that the doctor, and again, this was 1959, very different world. But the doctor came to my mother, seated by my little isolette or bassinet or whatever, and said, she's gone. Her kidneys have failed. Her other organs are quickly following. The toxins are taking over. We're not going to let you sit here and watch this baby die. Go home. You got three sons. Focus on the boys. And they sent my mother out. And she went home that night and prayed some more. And went and actually sat the night with her friend. And they prayed together. And the next morning, again, my mom didn't tell me this. I was in my 30s. The next morning, no news is good news. And there'd been no phone call in the night. She rushed into the hospital and a nun had me in her arms and handed me to my mother and said, this baby isn't better. She's healed. So I have always been very spiritual. I've always been the weirdo, the freak, the oddball that sees things other people don't see, that talks to the angels, that hears the angels, that feels the presence of angels. So when I had this hunger and thirst to read every NDE account I could get my hands on, I understood it a lot better. It all made a lot more sense. So yes, my background, I before my husband's suicide, I prayed for him three times a day because he was 8 years older. He was kind of overweight. He had a high stress job. I prayed for him literally morning, noon, and night. I had very specific prayers. When I hugged him before he went off to work to his high stress job, I would hug him for an extra few seconds, and I would visualize the light of perfect love just showering him with blessings, just pouring through his soul, eradicating any darkness, blessing him. And I always prayed very specifically for his heart, that God would enlarge his heart, bless his heart, keep his heart whole and free of any contaminants or anything worldly, anything unlike God. I mean, I put a lot of prayers into this man. So after his suicide, yes, I lost my faith, and yet it was the only thing I had. And in time, I had to come back around to realizing I don't know why this happened. I don't know anything about why I, who loved every day of my married life, who loved my husband as much as any woman ever loved a man, why this horror befell me. And once your spouse does this, and I don't know, maybe this is true for losing children to suicide as well, you become a societal leper because you are everybody's worst nightmare. Nobody wants this to happen to you. When you with this visitation, closed casket, not surprisingly, can't believe I paid a funeral home $14,000 to put his head back together. And then they said, whoop, not suitable for viewing, closed casket. But when the couples file past the casket at the visitation, you see them hold on to each other a little tighter. And just silently, you see in their eyes, they hope and pray something this horrible never happens. And the questions they ask, there must have been signs. Was there a note? What was he like the day before? And they're asking because they want to make sure this never happens to them. That's the real reason mm-hmm. they're asking. So I was very spiritual, and even though this washed me out, this wave of horror that came into my life literally swept me out to sea. And I realized the only chance I had of not drowning under the waves was to cling to the promises of God, to cling to the angels, to cling to all the things that I had known my 50 plus years of life. And I really think, I feel strongly that why did I get chosen? Why did I come back? I'm still a little miffed. A lot of days, I'm really miffed about this.
You're
you know?
Like, why?
Yeah.
You just got to watch the news and you're like, why did I come back?
I know. And I'm a sensitive soul. I'm a delicate person. Right. And I think part of it is my husband's suicide caused so much horror. It is a ripple effect. I heard it likened to a suicide bomber. Those nearest the suicide bomber suffer the most damage.
Right.
But everyone takes a bit of shrapnel. I think that in the big divine picture, in the picture of God and the angels and all that's full of light and love, my death was not a suitable ending. It was God saying, no, we're limiting the losses. We're not going to let this one go too. I really believe that's why I had to come back, because God was just saying, enough tragedy, enough loss, enough horror from one man's suicide. And plus, I get to tell the story. And while the near death thing, I prefer to call it temporary death. I wasn't near death. I was good and dead. I believe that one of the reasons, of course, is to share this story with others, not just because of the near death aspect, but as an encouragement to other people who are surviving unspeakable trauma and horror. I recently had a friend who suffered a tremendous, unspeakable tragedy, and I was able to reach out to her and help her. Just as people reached out to me and helped me after my husband's suicide. I mean, I met a man whose wife had killed herself. I met a woman whose child had killed himself. I met a lot of people that said, yeah, you're going to be pretty screwed up for a couple of years, maybe 5, maybe 10, but you're going to get through it. And it's not because I'm strong. It's just because the human nature, the human spirit is very resilient. We survived this stuff. And the people who say, oh, man, if my husband did this, I'd just lay down and right beside him and die. Well, guess what? Absent doing yourself in, that's not an option. If this kind of thing could kill somebody, I'd be dead.
So,
and stay dead.
So let me ask you this. You know, according to, you know, some religions, that suicide is considered a sin and taking your own life and, you know, you go to hell. Did your death convince you that there is no hell, or like my grandfather saw his mother, did you see or feel any presence of your husband or anybody of your family members?
That's actually a point of some consternation. I didn't see anybody, or if I did, I don't remember it. One minute I'm floating in this perfect blackness, and the next minute I'm in a white room. I don't remember the transition, and I have a theory that that's when Mom and my beloved
might have been
friends and family said, hey, girl, how you doing? Because honestly, my mother, I believe my mother was probably my soulmate. And if I had seen my mother and remembered it, there'd be no going back.
Right.
So I don't know if they were on the other side of the door. I don't know if I saw them and forgot. I don't know. And as to the heaven or hell question, I'm not trying to be dismissive, but I can tell you that, one, I didn't see him, which I consider a mercy. I don't need to see him.
Right.
What he did, and I know a lot of your listeners, there's so many reasons for suicide. People say, oh, it's depression. Not always. About 10% of suicides are what are known as revenge suicides. In other words, oh, wait till you see what this does to your life. There's a lot of reasons for suicide. And so what I believe is if people who genuinely suffer from mental illness and depression,
right,
and succumb, I cannot believe a merciful God would stick them in hell. I believe there's no difference between that and having your heart give out. What's the difference between your brain failing and your heart failing? And if I had succumbed to the temptations to end my own life, would I have ended up in hell? Again, I think it goes back to motivation. I've always believed that God must be, has got to be, at least as kind and decent, as good as my own dear mother.
That's
and our own dear mothers,
yeah,
you know, look at us and say, well, why did you do that?
Right. Right. I always wondered why they said a vengeful God when your parents, mostly the mothers, not all, but mostly the mothers, no matter what you do, they love you unconditionally. And I'm like, how would a God, you know, frown upon you? So, yeah. But because we have about 10 minutes left, but I always like to include our people in the chat room. So thank you guys again, always, for being a part of this show. We have the amazing Rosemary Thornton with us today. She is a near-death experiencer. She's an author. And I wanted to look, there's a question for you from Van, and it says, do you think if your personality changed after that experience, did some kind of energy merge into you during this? Do you feel like, did you get filled with a different type of energy coming back, or addition to your own soul? What was that change like, or did it happen?
That's a really interesting question. Was I infused with energy? Boy, yeah. I love to think so. I do think it was a reset. In my case, my husband's suicide had been so painful. This was a reset. It was a reset to who I really am. It was like, again, the word that came to me, what the angel said, was all the muck and horror of the world had been encapsulated. They didn't say it was gone and that it never happened or that it was expunged. I mean, I suffered mightily for 29 months. The horrors of the damn. I mean, I lived in a nice house with my husband. People don't move into a car, a Camry, unless they're pretty messed up in the head. I suffered prescription drug abuse, alcohol abuse, blah, blah, blah. So I think it was all that horror was encapsulated, and I was given a new chance. I was literally given, I guess my easiest way to interpret it is Psalm 23, He restoreth my soul. You know, the medical world likes to think they know how to fix our bodies.
Right.
But how do you restore a soul? And that's what happened to me. And as far as the new me, as soon as I came back from this, people love this part, I sold off all my worldly possessions. I sold my shiny new car that I had just gotten, white leather interior. I sold off every single thing I have, with few exceptions. And then I put my house on the market, sold it, sold in 2 hours. Got my slightly used Prius, and I drove 1,000 miles due west to the St. Louis area to start a new life. So did it change me? Yes, in a lot of ways, but mainly it gave me the freedom to become the woman of God's creating. That was the biggest change. It really was like being reset to an innocent and pure child of God.
So what just popped into my head is, what can we do on earth instead of having a near-death experience to realize the importance of who we are and the purpose of what we're supposed to do and be? And, you know, because it seems like many of the people that have near death, like my grandfather, he everybody loved him. I mean, he was just a pillar of community in my hometown. But why does it take a near death to change our perspective and our views on the life we're living on this time around? What can we do to realize that without having a NDE?
That's a really good question, and I don't know that there's a simple answer. In my case, I had become so far removed from who I wanted to be, mm-hmm. who I could be, from my potential. You know, when my girls were little, I had three daughters. When my daughters were little, I used to pray every morning, God, help them realize their full potential. And I think I just got off the path so far. And once he killed himself, I was lost in the darkest of woods. To answer your question, I think it takes meditation, it takes prayer, and asking, help me realize my full potential. You know, help me strip off the muck of the world. Help me remember who I am created to be. You know, Wayne Dyer, who was a motivational speaker, right. He had a great expression. He used to say, don't die with your music still in you. And have you ever heard of Bernie Siegel? He wrote Medicine and Miracles. You ever read that book?
I have not, but I definitely know who he is.
As I recall, he was an oncologist, and he would often diagnose people and say, well, you know, I'm sorry, go home. You got 3 to 6 months to live.
Right.
And he would find these people walking around 3, 4, 5, 10 years later. And so he actually started doing research as Love, Medicine, and Miracles. That was the name of the book. And he asked them, okay, what are you doing? And they said, well, you know, I got divorced. I got married. I got rid of the car. I bought a new car. I got rid of the house. I declared bankruptcy. In other words, they lived the life. A death diagnosis or a prognostication gave them the freedom to go to shed the earth weights and to go live the life they always wanted to live.
Right.
And in doing so, they experienced remission. It's kind of like disease gave them permission to just shed all this heavy stuff of earth.
And I mean, I really think, you know, I was born in 69, so, you know, 51 years ago, where when I was even a teenager, we didn't have the cell phones and the computers, and, you know, we had, you know, four channels until my dad got a satellite in the 80s. But we didn't have a lot of the pressures of what we have today. And I think even now there's so much, not saying that we never had the pressures of, you know, the parents to become who they wanted us to be, or society pressure us to what they think we're supposed to be. But nowadays I can see why there's besides, you know, the foods and the environment, but I can see where the stress of social media and trying to be somebody we're not, you know, it can cause a lot of people's delusions of who we're supposed to be, where, like you said, when you get a near-death experience, a lot of people, all that doesn't matter once they come back like you said, you sold everything because it's the weight of what people assumed you're supposed to be a certain person. So,
I'm sure, do you now like think of what's my purpose, or do you know my purpose? Cause in a lot of us still go, okay, I'm doing this, I love it, but I thought I knew my purpose, but maybe that's not it. Do you feel like now that you know what purpose that you're supposed to be here?
I do not. And it frustrates the heck out of me because it seems like a person who comes back from the dead after bleeding to death and has this remarkable experience should be pretty clear on this stuff. And I'm not. I have just finished a book, and I hope to have it on Amazon within a month. But the title is Remembering the Light, How Dying Yes. Saved My Life. Because the only purpose I can come up with is opportunities like this to share with others what happened. And I understand it sounds almost unbelievable, but I am a historian. I put great stock in accuracy and veracity and telling the truth and telling it accurately. And honestly, it would be so much easier to continue living my quiet little life in a sleepy little town in southwestern Illinois and just, you know, go sit in the field and watch the corn grow, which does happen to be one of my very favorite things. I'm in an agricultural community. Or go hang out at the farm, local farm supply store, and watch the baby chicks scurry about. But I feel like I need to share this story. But yeah, right. I get crap for this story. You know, oh, well, it was probably just a spontaneous remission. Oh, really? You die with stage 2 cancer and you come back and it's gone? You die at age 59 from bleeding out, gone 10 minutes, and you come back completely whole and restored with no peripheral problems? I understand for some it's a hard sell, but yeah, my life would have been a lot simpler if I just, you know, kept taking my lawn chair out to the back 40 of my neighbor's right. house and watching the corn grow.
Right, yeah. I used to like paint dry. No, I was kidding.
The corn, have you ever watched corn in a field? They have hundreds and they have fields out here. I'm actually in Jersey County, which is the southwestern part of Illinois, which is right across the river from St. Louis. But they have hundreds and hundreds of acres, and because it's near the bluffs of the Mississippi, it's rolling hills. And if you sit out there and a wind comes up from, the wind would come from the west.
The wave of the...
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, those golden tassels on top of the corn. It's one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen.
No, I grew up in Kansas, so we had wheat and corn. So yeah, in the middle of the Flint Hills, I think we had like 200, well, I'd say people, but that's probably cats, dogs, and in my hometown. So, yeah, I know what you're talking about. But, yeah, life, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, that's so boring. But actually, when you go back and just enjoy that simple life, it's you have more time to reflect on things. You have more time to think about life. You have more time to have deep conversations where, you know, living in Los Angeles now, everybody's go, 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 get, you know, have to get everything done and be somebody, you know, there, you know, this is a town of pretend. So yeah, it's, that's why I love doing these stories. And like I said, it's true to my heart because like I said, my grandfather told me the stories of his near death and it's, you know, that's when I said, well, this is a man of integrity. He would not make, you know, well, he would make a, you know, caught a 2-pound bass and it would end up being a 10-pound bass. But other than that, he didn't make stuff up just to make stuff up. And, but this is so fascinating. And Rosemary, I really appreciate you being here and I hope you come back again. Tell us again when the book comes out, the title and where people can get it.
Okay. Well, the title's Remembering the Light, How Dying Saved My Life. I hope in about 30 days it'll be up at Amazon.com as an ebook.
And I love you. You're a great speaker. I think you should be going out and doing a lot more speaking gigs and events. You know, get out there because you can tell you have a great heart and a great soul and appreciate you sharing it with us.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, everybody. As always, you can not only
subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us on our podcast, on Apple Podcast. Please subscribe. Please leave a positive comment. iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon. And also, if you're in the Boston area, please watch us on WCRN TV 31. This will be playing probably in the next few weeks. So we really appreciate you guys supporting us all these years. And until next time, I'm Tony Sweet for Truth Be Told. Take care.